Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we interview Mitch Weiss, who's the author of the book The Business of Broadway. Peter, Michael, and Carrie join in for reviews of the Public Theater's production of Cymbeline and the Broadway production of Hamilton. Peter reviews the 1214 Foundation's production of Liberty Smith at Newtown High School, and we talk about Carrie's article from Playbill, Career or Children, Why Theater Parents Feel Forced to Choose. That plus more. Please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, August 16th, 2015. It's a hot one here in New York, and my name is James Marino. With us this morning, we have Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and Carrie Purcell. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Kritzerland, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist. His work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and many other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
Also with us is Carrie Purcell. Carrie is a staff writer and features editor at Playbill.com. Her new column, A Woman's World, focuses on uncovering women's issues both on and off Broadway by highlighting successful women in the industry and the challenges that they have faced. She can be followed on Twitter at PlaybillCarrie and at her blog at CarriePurcell.com. Good morning, Carrie.
Good morning.
With us today, we have a very special guest. Mitch Weiss, who is the co-author of The Business of Broadway, is joining us to tell us about what it's like to write a book that talks about the Broadway business. The subtitle of the book is An Insider's Guide to Working, Producing, and Investing in the World's Greatest Theater Community. Hi, Mitch. How are you?
Hi, James. Great to talk to you.
Well, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it. I was very intrigued by this book. I love process books about how to get from point A to point B. And a lot of our listeners are either students or people that run regional theaters. And this type of information doesn't very often make it out there because we're so enthralled with videos of cell phone people plugging stuff in on stage. And so the real information doesn't make it out. Unless you come to New York and work for a producer or a GM. And so I want to know, what's your story? How did you acquire all this knowledge?
Well, it's a lot of it has to do with age and being around long enough to have accumulated knowledge. As a manager, the greatest part of the job is I know what everybody else's life is about. Mm-hmm. I know when the wardrobe person has an aunt who is sick. I know when someone's pregnant. I know if someone's drunk. I know if someone has a complaint against someone else. I know what everyone's getting paid. I know how they got their job and whose relative they are. Every aspect of every part of the show is very personal for me because that's how I help keep everybody working together.
And you're talking about the general manager's position in a Broadway show, right?
And company manager.
And a company manager, yeah.
Yeah, the company manager job is the day-to-day running of the show, while the general manager oversees the larger picture and the negotiations and the setting up of the show and makes the largest decisions. But the company manager is at every show and therefore represents the producer and the general manager on a moment-by-moment basis.
So how did you get into this? What was your first job in theater and in Broadway?
Well, actually, I started as a musical director and a composer. I had a few shows produced regionally. But I wanted to learn from the best. I guess the option was, do I become a big fish in a small pond? Or do I get to be a small fish in a big pond? And I always wanted to work for Hal Prince. That was my dream.
Great.
And my first job on Broadway was the original Pacific Overtures, working for Hal Prince and wow. Steve Sondheim. It was glorious. I was the assistant press rep, which of course is not something I aspired to be, but it was. I would have emptied garbage cans, so it didn't matter to me. And I learned a tremendous amount on that show in just the few months that it ran. It opened the same year as A Chorus Line and Chicago. So it didn't have a chance in, excuse the expression, hell.
Yeah.
although it did win 2 Tony Awards, and it did win Drama Desk? No, it wasn't the Drama Desk. It may have been. It was Best Musical, but that was because it was the previous year from A Chorus Line. Mm. But it won one of the big awards, and it was a wonderful show. I got to work with my first big celebrity as the assistant press rep. I got to escort Elizabeth Taylor in all her glory backstage and introduce her to a cast that was all Asian American. Asao Sato and Saab Shimono and Mako. I had a lot to learn.
So I'm going through your bio here, and it says you've managed about several hundred Broadway and off-Broadway shows, including Tony Award winners, A Chorus Line, Grapes of Wrath, and Beauty and the Beast. So how did you get from the assistant press rep all the way into the company manager and GM office?
Part luck, part because I was constantly introducing myself to people and walking into people's offices. After the few months on Pacific Overtures, I ended up in producer Kermit Bloomgarden's office, who was doing Equus and opening Poor Murderer, which was not a success. And it was better than waiting on tables for me. And I still thought I was going to end up a musical director. In fact, when I was on Pacific Overtures, I played piano for some of the actors in the chorus who were auditioning for other shows, and they would ask me to just, you know, accompany them. So I was keeping that going, but I was thrilled to end up on Equus and Poor Murderer, and Kermit Bloomgarden, another amazing producer, you know, having done The Miracle Worker and Diary of Anne Frank. And of course, working on Equus was glorious. And from there, I finally figured out what was going on. And the next person I had to work for was Joe Papp. And it took me a couple of years to get there, and a lot of unemployment. But I eventually made it into the public theater, and I was there for 8.5 years. And that kind of solidified my life that as a manager, that's where I was headed, and that's what I was going to end up doing.
So you also have been a member of ATPAM since 1985. So tell our listeners who don't know what ATPAM is, what it is and how that relates to Broadway.
Yes, and please, anybody who's thinking of it, join ATPAM. Be a manager. The Association of Theatrical Press Agents and Managers, it's one of 18 unions on Broadway, which amazes many people. There are very few industries that is so unionized. But then again, there are still unscrupulous people out there who would find a way not to pay people on Broadway if they could. So unions help make sure that happens. They help make sure we get pensions and health care. It's not so much that we get paid that much. It's just the benefits and the security. So I very much am a union guy. Job of manager really is one that requires an apprenticeship for a couple of years under another manager. And then you have to take a written and oral test, very much like going to law school, because it's your job to make sure your producer and general manager don't get caught in penalties and make big financial mistakes on the show. And the best part of the job, I have to tell you, James, this is so much fun. You do a $15 million musical. You get to spend all $15 million 8 weeks It's your job to spend it. You get people walk up to you and say, you know, that costume is going to cost $150,000. Well, you may not be the one making the ultimate decision, but in general, you're the one who's giving them $150,000 to buy and build that costume. It's great. And of course, I walked out 1985, my first show, having joined the union by then, having gone through the apprentice program, my first show was a Chorus Line. And it was already running, of course, but it was heaven. Everyone loved the show. Everyone was excited to be working on it. Everyone was nice to each other. There was money galore to pay for problems. Joe Papp and Michael Bennett cared about this show tremendously, so you could get things done quickly and you could learn from them. It was the best lesson and the best job I've ever had.
Well, that's awesome. So you've taken all these experiences that you've had through the years and turned them into this this book, The Business of Broadway. So what inspired you to write this book?
I will tell you two things. And two very specific things. We managers and press agents talk about this all the time. And we say to each other, if one more producer walks up to us and says, hey, I've got a few empty seats, why don't we take out a full page ad in the Sunday New York Times? And then you look at them and say, do you have any idea how much that cost? And they look at you blank. And you say, but you're in charge of this. Before you make stupid decisions, you ought to know that currently it's over $60,000 for one time, one page, and it used to be $140,000 when paper newspapers actually existed. And you don't even have that much in the bank. So you want to go, well, how do I inform people about this information before they make decisions? And that was impetus number one. These investors who don't even know what a general manager is supposed to do, and the producers who think, you know, I ran a very successful dry cleaning business, I can do the same thing in theater. Well, yeah, but you ought to know how it works. So telling them about why there are two sets of stagehands on every show, and why that makes sense as opposed to getting angry at it, and why the musicians are paid by the theater and not by the producer, and why this costs this amount and why that costs that amount, and why you shouldn't waste your marketing money on this versus that. Tried to put it all in one book. But number two, I teach, guest teach at various colleges. And the arts administration programs, these students do not know that they can work on Broadway even if they're not an actor. There are all of these jobs on every show. On the big musicals, I hire 200 different positions. And so how many of them can be actors or, you know, directors or playwrights? There are a lot of jobs, and you can be part of this exciting place, and you can bring it back to your regional theater as opposed to always being in the red in your nonprofit regional theater. You can learn about ways to earn a buck and do new theater and still have the freedom of going back to your regional theater. There's a lot to learn this way, and I'm trying to encourage people to do it. So I list all the jobs, how much money you make, how you get the jobs, who you write to. And I'm trying to encourage people to join us.
So you've created a blueprint for Broadway success.
That's the right word.
Which is incredibly awesome. You might be the one person who can answer this question better than anybody else we've ever talked to on Broadway Radio. Uh-oh. Is there any way to, you know, you brought up the extremely valid point. You've hired 200 some odd people for a show. Is there any way to get control over prices of theater tickets? If you had the magic bullet, is there any way to do it? I mean, I know that it, when you're paying 200 people a living wage, you know, it's expensive. And so your running costs might be the $400,000-$600,000 a week that we hear reported on running costs for some smaller shows. So what do you think?
Well, I don't want to make a blanket statement.
But sure, absolutely.
But I'm going to make a blanket
statement. Okay.
For a hit show, all they have to do is drop the prices. There's plenty of money. For a show that is suffering, it's going to close anyway. And even though you want it to run as long as possible for the salaries and, you know, certainly if it's enjoyable, just not a big hit, you want to give it a chance. But the truth is, greed is everywhere. And it is not the fault of the stagehands nor the musicians. They make a living wage and that's it. There are just a lot of people. I think regarding union salaries, an electrician once told me, if you don't tell me that you need to sink the Titanic every night on stage, you don't have to hire as many of us. You can just have a set that looks great but isn't intricate and troublesome, and therefore we will only ask you to hire the fewest number of stagehands needed. But if the producer and the general manager come to us and say, I need 4,000 things to happen at the same moment, we're going to tell you how many people it takes to make that work 8 times a week. And that's what's going to cost you the money. So either you follow the Disney path, the Cameron Mackintosh path, in which you have to lift an entire Sunset Boulevard set up into the air so that you can do a scene underneath it, or you don't. And that's where the costs are. It's wonderful to see magic on stage. Don't get me wrong. But it is about the planning and the design that determines what the costs are. There are simple shows on Broadway that charge as much as the intricate shows without reason, except greed. Other than that, I don't know what else to tell you. It's a horror to me, yet the problem with premium pricing, which is great, believe me, as a manager, I want as much money from my producer and investors as possible. But the fact that there are people willing to spend $450 a seat to see Book of Mormon is outrageous, but they're willing. And it's very hard to drop prices if there are people out there, perhaps the one percenters, perhaps not, they're willing to spend that money. How do we convince people to not buy those tickets? I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, it's you know, really something. You bring up Sunset Boulevard. It's exactly what I thought of immediately. You know, did we need to lift the house so Joe Gillis could walk underneath it and sing half of a song and things like that? So maybe the spectacle of it all added to it, but certainly, you know, when you have shows with 200 some odd people in it, they're expensive and people have to make a living, and it's expensive to live in New York, in and around New York. So these things happen.
Yeah, but very few people go home with more than enough money to just pay their rent. There are very few rich people coming out of these shows, except in some cases the investors, and good for them. I'm not against that.
Mm-hmm.
But not the workers. There are very few people that I would argue with their salary.
So tell us about, you know, the book. You're walking through it. It's very nicely broken down into easily understandable categories. And so I encourage, we have lots of students that listen to this broadcast. So if you are somebody who wants to understand, you know, what A, B, or C does, you know, what does a wardrobe manager do? And what does a sound person do? What does a lighting designer do? You know, other than the actor, director, and choreographer that everybody seems to have a good grasp on, the rest of it is a big mystery to it. And so I encourage people to pick up the book and get it. So can they get this at Drama Bookshop, on Amazon, and BarnesandNoble.com? Where can they get it?
All of those. It is sitting at Drama Bookshop. It is on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's at the NYU bookstore. Hopefully we're going to get some other universities to use it as a textbook for some practical resource, but we'll see if that happens. The book just came out. And, you know, as I said, my hope is that it encourages people to invest and to work on Broadway. Yes, there are only so many jobs, but, you know, people who love pets or know how, you know, like training them or raising dogs, we only really have one phenomenal dog trainer on Broadway, Bill Berlone. There's room for more. If you like children, we have people backstage who are wranglers, and they're part of a union. We have, if you like designing hair, you don't only have to be a hairdresser. They're on every show. We're designing wigs. We have them on every show. There's a lot of choices, and you make a living. You're not going to get filthy rich this way, but you do make a living.
Was it Roger Berlin says the best way to make $1 million on Broadway is to start with $10 million?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's, you know, and it's also very sad. We all go into this business thinking there's a chance we're going to make a lot of money, but not that's not our impetus. And unfortunately, the arts need to be subsidized. Even with Broadway being making a billion three this year.
Yeah.
It's a lot of tourists. It's not enough to make anybody on the shows go home rich.
Well, you know, you worked at the Public down with Joseph Papp, and you know, you don't make a lot of money putting on free shows in Central Park. So we have to have people out there that come to support it.
Right.
So outside of your book, you have a website, Just Learn Something, that also, is this a compliment to the book, or what is Just Learn Something?
Yeah, it is, but first of all, it's important to say it's justlearnsomething.us.
Yes.
Okay, not .com or .net. Uh-huh. First of all, there are excerpts from the book on there. There's a way to make comments and have a discussion with the authors. We are going to post some future discussions and updates, because you know, every 3 months, some union is renegotiating its prices, and the book, that we put out has the prices as of now. So mm-hmm. We plan to update it on there. We're also hoping to start a few classes, you know, outside of regular school for next to no money, to just help people learn the practical side of theater. And to see if this is where they want to spend their life. You know, I've also worked in regional theaters and certainly nonprofits, which, by the way, are allowed to make profit under the law. They're just not allowed to give it to investors. Broadway has a whole bunch of not-for-profit theaters, that some of which shouldn't be not-for-profit, but that's another story. But so, you know, you can work in Nashville or in Omaha and still hopefully get something, not just from the book, but also by just signing up to be part of the discussion on justlearnsomething.us.
All right. Well, Mitch, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about the book. It is The Business of Broadway, which is available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Stop by the Drama Bookshop and get it there, too. And also stop by justlearnsomething.us to join in the conversation. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate
James,
it.
I really appreciate you and this chance. Thank you. First time I'm thinking past tomorrow.
All right, let's get on to our reviews. The first show that we're going to talk about is In the Park, and Peter, Carrie, and Michael have seen it, and we have to have a discussion about the name of this show, because it is at Cymbeline? Cymbeline? Cymbal what? So, Peter, what's your take on Cymbeline?
Well, back in 1961, there was a marvelous musical called Kean about Edmund Kean, the famous Shakespearean actor of the 19th century. And it opened with a merchandise guy. You thought that was something new in the theater, but no. Actually, here he is selling pictures of Edmund Kean. Some of them are in color and some of them are in black and white. And you pay penny for the plain one and tuppence for the colored one. So anyway, he talks about the hugest pictures of Edmund Kean in Hamlet, Lear, and Cymbeline. So I've always said Cymbeline, but Michael, what did you say?
Well,
you
have I've always said Cymbeline too, but then somebody corrected me and said Cymbeline. And so I looked it up, and from what I found, it's Cymbeline.
Uh-huh.
So I guess we can take our pick.
We should ask Christian Borle.
Right. Very good.
Carrie, you want to weigh in here? Anything?
I don't think I can come up with any other pronunciations. I think you guys have covered them all.
I think the Q is silent. So let's skip the pronunciation and we'll go with that show in the park. And Peter, give us your review on that. What do you think?
It's a beautiful word, no matter how you pronounce it, isn't it? Yes. I think it's quite a thing. Anyway, Cymbeline's a king, but frankly, his wife makes a lot of decisions here. And one of the decisions she makes is that her son from a previous marriage is going to marry his daughter. Now, it's not that she thinks that they'd make such a cute couple together. It's just in those days, we're talking 9 AD, that's a long time ago, that in those days, if a man married a princess, when the king died, he became king. So that's what she really wants. That's what's going on here. So, of course, the daughter, Imogen, has a boyfriend herself. Posthumus is his name. And the queen wishes he was Posthumus, I'll tell you, because she wants to kill him and her. And I mean, so this is considered to be not one of Shakespeare's greatest. But I'll tell you, you can't tell from this production. Dan Solomon, I guess nobody told him that it was second-tier Shakespeare, because they really make it into an entertaining class. Now, the thing is, it is 3 hours long, no question about that. And that's a long time to sit in front of any drama, though, of course, if you're outdoor at the Delacorte on a pleasant evening, not necessarily tonight, but on a pleasant evening, the time goes a little faster than it might. So so it's a very good production, I think, and certainly Patrick Page is the king, but the thing is, I wonder if the budget is a little tight at the Shakespeare Festival because what we're dealing with here is 9 people. This is the most modest production I can ever recall in terms of cast size at the Delacorte, and I've been going about 40 years. But there's a lot of doubling. And the wonderful thing about it is you might not even realize it, especially with Hamish Linklater, who plays Posthumus, the romantic lead, and yet plays Cloten, the son of the queen, who's a real dullard. And I think a lot of people would be surprised to realize it's the same actor. So he's especially good at the doubling. Well, anyway, Posthumus brags that his girlfriend loves him and would never cheat on him. But he says this at a bar where Raoul Espaza's character, Iacomo, and notice Iacomo almost has the same letters as Iago. I mean, they're very similar in the sense that they're evil people. So Raoul's character says, oh, I can get her into bed. And that leads into a lot of complications that cause everybody a lot of concern and a lot of problems. Lily Rabe, by the way, is Imogen. She does a lovely job, just a lovely job. And Patrick Page has a voice that makes a bedroom voice that makes Barry White seem like Minnie Mouse's. So he's very good, too. And really, Kate Burton is terrific. Not only is the queen looking like she stepped out of an Edward Gorey drawing, but also playing Belarius, a guy. And it'll take a while before some people realize that this is Kate Burton. So this is more than a case of you get what you pay for, because you really get a lot in this production, not just time-wise, but a terrific tour de force in terms of people doubling. But I hope it's because the director said, oh, we can do it this way, rather than the fact that Oscar Eustace said to him, Dan, we can only afford 9 people. So I hope it's not that. So that's my take on Cymbeline.
I've never known the public theater to shy away from a budget.
Yeah, well,
so
times is hard.
Listeners have emailed me and asked why we took so long to review this. And we want to point out that although it opened on the 23rd, it started performances on the 23rd of July, and they go through the 23rd of August, which is only a week away. Their official opening night was only this week, I think it was. Wasn't that true?
Yeah, I believe so.
It was.
They take a long time before they bring people in.
And you might want to listen to our previous episode with Raul Esparza on, and he talks about the rehearsal process for the second show in the park, which is truncated above the first show. It seems like the first show has the luxury of time, but the second show is a little bit rushed. So, Michael, what is your take on this show?
Well, I noticed the doubling as soon as I opened the program, which I don't always do beforehand, but this time I did. And it surprised me just reading it in the program. It is worth mentioning that this show has a live orchestra, but it's only 4 people, 4 or 5 people. So I guess maybe some of the budget went to that. And by the way, they're playing some really great music by Tom Kitt. I would say there were 3 or 4 songs in the show, and one of them was really, really, really beautiful. It's a duet that happens towards the end, a duet between David Fur and Jacob Ming Trent. Did you guys notice that song?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I know which one.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was really beautiful. I thought in the case of Posthumus Leonidas and Cloten, or Cloten, whatever it is, being doubled, I kind of assumed that was a definite artistic decision, and spurred on by the fact that the 2 characters are never on stage at the same time. And it's interesting because one is the person whom the princess is truly in love with, Posthumus Leonidas, and the other one is her unwanted suitor. And Hamish Linklater, as Peter mentioned, he's so good at the 2 different voices that he did, and that ridiculous wig he used for Cloten was really something. I had an interesting reaction, though. Cloten is played as a real dullard and really vulgar and kind of stupid, and he's that's his traditional role, but he was so delightful as played by Hamish Linklater that when he meets his end rather abruptly, I felt really bad for him. You know, and especially the way that he meets his end, it's really kind of barbaric. So that's interesting. But, you know, that's always been one of the best things about Shakespeare, that we see the humanity even in some of the less reputable characters. I as far as Kate Burton, I thought she was fantastic. And also it was interesting to me that the role was played so differently from Felicia Rashad's conception of the role several years ago at Lincoln Center, that it might almost have been a different role, a different play. And now obviously a lot of this is due to the director, but how interesting that such polar opposite portrayals can be so effective. And I thought everyone was great. I thought Raul, I thought it was one of his best roles ever. I did feel I was not bored or for a second. I thought it was incredibly entertaining. I thought the use of the sort of play within a play concept was not terribly consistent throughout the show. And I also am not sure that it helped to have such wildly different styles of presentation for certain scenes. For example, when Raoul comes out, he sings a song that was written exactly as a Vegas lounge act. And it was, the audience loved it. He sounded great. He sounded fantastic. But nothing else in the show was like that. And it did kind of just seem like,
yeah, that's fair. That's
skipping from style to style. I suppose Dan Sullivan, who is a great director, did it because, recognizing the fact that I guess this would be called a problem play. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's what they call the ones that aren't very good.
Yeah, I mean, but not very good, but also what wonderful moments, really. There was one line that struck me. I literally went, oh. She says something, Imogen says, someone's about to hand her a note, and she fears that it has bad news about Posthumus Leonidas, and she says, why tender me so untender a message? And I thought, oh, gee, that's really beautiful, Will. So good for him. And it's so great to see it in the park, as always. And with all of the trappings of that, and you get to see a lot of the foliage in back of the stage in this production, which you did not in the last one. And really a very, very, very strong cast across the board. I completely agree about Patrick Page. David Furr, I haven't seen in a while. It was great to see him back again. And Lily Rabe, that voice, she also has such a distinctive voice that she uses so well to her advantage. So I think they deserve a lot of applause for this one.
And I didn't see this production, but I was over at the Public's website looking at this, and what a good-looking cast. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
So, Carrie, what's your take on this?
Well, I thought the use of the actors doubling up was to go with the play within a play concept. It didn't occur to me that they had cut back on the budget. I thought it just tied in with how they had the crates and boxes on the sides of the stage with the names of other plays on them, and with everyone sitting back and watching it. And I do think that Hamish playing the two roles was a great idea, because he got to show off his incredible talent in both types of characters.
I'm sure you're right. I'm sure you're right that was part of that concept.
Yeah. This was a problem play for me, because it, even keeping in mind when it was written, I really struggled with the idea of a woman's privacy being violated the way it was, and also just so much discussion and violence and even death due to the idea of someone's chastity. So I found myself, despite an incredible cast, a beautiful setting, and I had the good fortune to be there on a beautiful night with great weather, found myself rolling my eyes a few times. And a friend of mine who's directed the play at his college was watching me to see if I was going to lose my cool. I think that the cast was fantastic. I would listen to Patrick Page read the phone book, and I'm thrilled, absolutely thrilled he's going to be in the revival of Spring Awakening. I think that's a great role for him, and I'm excited to see him on Broadway again. Mm. And I love watching Lily Rabe do Shakespeare. I think that she brings so much strength to her characters, and just the way she delivers her lines, the way she stands, her presence on stage is really inspiring to me. And I think that she finds depth in characters that might not be found in the hands of a less experienced actress. I would love to just listen to her and Hamish eat dinner and talk. Because I think they'd, even off stage in real life, they probably just have the most brilliant poetic conversations, probably in iambic pentameter.
I think we all like to think that. Yes, I hope that's true.
I did find myself kind of noticing all these other Shakespearean plays. I don't know if they were referenced or if it was just coincidence, but the idea of the sleeping potion, the idea of the woman dressing as a man, there are many plays that go into, in my opinion, annoying detail about whether or not a woman is faithful to her lover, but it felt like Shakespeare's greatest hits mashed together.
This one is not, in those terms, this one isn't nearly as bad as Much Ado.
I know.
I mean, that is the worst, you know, because in this case, at least, it's just, it's like confined to Posthumus Leonidas, who thinks she's been unfaithful, and it's not like the whole town is condemning her. And
it's a testament to Lily and Hamish's skill that I truly did enjoy watching Much Ado About Nothing, even while thinking, I'm not so cool with this. It's a real education for a 21st century woman to be watching these plays and seeing in the hands of great actors, wow, this actually did happen. And this was entertainment back then.
But you know what somebody said to me while we were watching it, and this is true, we kind of arrived at this together. It's it may be that the women are the object of the scorn, but it's the men who are always in the wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, try to think of a lover character in Shakespeare who is a female lover character who is not wise and good and not prone to all of these horrible fits of jealousy and going off on tirades. I can't really think of it. It's always the guys.
Oh, I've always said Juliet is years ahead of Romeo intelligence and her practical skill, and the fact that she makes fun of him the first time that he tries to woo her. She tells him to go pray.
No, that's
Gertrude isn't so nice, but not in the way you're talking about. So,
the central lover character. I mean, yeah, there's Lady M too. You know, she's not so great, but
Margaret Henry the Sixth Part Three. She's a tough one. Whoa, but that's another story too. Okay,
we should have Tina Packer on to talk about this.
Yeah, that would be good.
Who did Women of Will a few years ago?
Yeah,
it's terrific.
Oh, that's great. So, Carrie, I'm surprised that Cymbeline that was produced back in 1600s or so, that would surprise you that the attitudes that were shown there are very similar to the attitudes of the 1980s, 90s, and 2000s. So I'm not really shocked by that. But let's jump back into the 1700s. And where there's some little off-Broadway show that has made it to the Great White Way. I don't know if anybody's heard of it, called Hamilton or something like that. We should work on the pronunciation of that one. And Michael, Carrie, and I have seen it. Peter's going to see it this week, and he'll talk about it next week. But Carrie, why don't you start us off with Hamilton?
Oh, how much time have we got? It's so exciting to have seen this show in its development, going from off-Broadway to Broadway, and seeing how it really does present the form of musical theater and storytelling in, I think, a truly unique and new way. And I think that it's fantastic. It's got a diverse cast, that the founding fathers are all played by men who are not white, and that the three sisters are played by women of different backgrounds. I think that the variety of music in the show is absolutely stunning. The storytelling told through rap there's so much information packed into every line. I'm just in awe of Lin-Manuel Miranda for writing this and being able to take this 700-page book and all this history and all this detail, this incredibly intimate detail about this man's life, and put it into these rhythms that I have not been able to get out of my head since seeing it. And I also have a really deep appreciation for how he presented the women in Hamilton's life as these truly, in my opinion, detailed, fleshed out, full characters. And the story ended with Hamilton's wife center stage and Hamilton standing behind her and her talking about what she did, spoiler alert, after he dies. And I have so much appreciation to him for presenting their marriage and their family and it not only being about the man. And the choreography is outstanding. And those dancers are never off the stage. They are doing an incredible job up there for another very lengthy musical. I don't think they ever stop moving.
Yeah.
And I'm just so happy to see this on Broadway, to see it receiving this attention and this acclaim and this recognition. And it really does... It really does hint towards a continuing evolvement of musical theater and what that will be in the future.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Yeah, I was thinking that somebody could have just done a colorblind cast version of 1776. But how much better? Now we have this brilliant new musical that is... an addition to the literature and everyone loves it. It's I can't think of a negative about it. It takes a historical story that involved all white people and mostly men and opens it up. to people of all colors, because that's the way it's written. And the one of the salient lines in it is, "Immigrants, we get the job done," which always I've seen the show twice, once off Broadway and once on, and that always gets an incredible response from the audience. That thing at the ending that Carrie referred to, it's so extraordinary. I had tears in my eyes, and people around me were crying at the end. The way it, first of all, the way that Hamilton's wife forgives him after what happens, you know, with her, you know, the betrayal, if you will, the sexual betrayal, and then they have that moment where you actually see the forgiveness happen, and that's overwhelming. And then it goes on, and then he gets shot, and then it turns out that she is the custodian of his story, his history. And that the very last moment where she kind of realizes that herself, and she gives that little gasp. Everyone around me was just crying. Jane Lynch was sitting behind me. She was crying. she was like really sobbing. It's an extraordinary piece. If I could say anything negative about it, the only thing I would say is that so much is being thrown at you so quickly, because rap tends to move so quickly, that I didn't have trouble understanding a single word, but absorbing is another question. So it's sometimes I just kind of let it wash over me, and you know, was getting the general gist without being able to process each line. I cannot wait for the cast album. I know it's going to be one of my most played cast albums of all, and I think every school group in the world will see this show, and it could probably keep running on that alone. It's absolutely brilliant. I'm sorry that some things get hype undeservedly, because then when something like this comes along and everybody goes crazy, I think some people's reaction is to, oh, come on, it can't be that good. But it really is. It really is that good.
That was the opening line of the New York Times review. Yes, it really is that good. If I can jump back in just really quickly, I also think it's worth noting how Lin-Manuel recognizes how devoted his fans are. And I think it's pretty awesome that for the lottery every day, the cast goes out there and, or not every day, but the cast does go out there and perform for the people who have been waiting in line for hours. And I just think I've never seen anything like that really happen before. And I think it's really, really sweet and wonderful how they recognize the devotion of their fans. When I was going backstage to interview a cast member recently, the press agent told me, wait at the stage door. And I thought, really? Because you won't be able to find me.
Who did you interview?
I interviewed Lin's standby, Javier Muñez.
Oh, great.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
He was the one who performed for Barack Obama Saturday afternoon. But it did take a while to find the press agent, because there were a lot of fans there.
Okay, I have a question. Now, here we are with a show with non-traditional casting, and there's already been talk about movies, movie version. Now, non-traditional casting has been the province of theater. You don't see it on TV. You don't see it in movies. What will happen when this becomes a movie? Will they do it? And will the public who goes to movies, who doesn't go to theater, be thoroughly flummoxed by the whole idea of seeing? But in real life, that wasn't a black guy. That was a white guy. I mean,
I don't think so.
Will
because
it play in Iowa? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I guess I am.
Well, no, because it's written specifically for that. It's not as if they're playing the historic George Washington and Aaron Burr and Eliza Hamilton, et cetera. So I think for that reason that the movie audience should be able to accept it unquestionably.
Yeah,
if the movie audience wants faithful depictions, then we've got to get people with wooden teeth and really bad skin. And
exactly.
I mean, we're not going to see Hanson and Katy Perry and Hamilton in the film of Hamilton.
Oh, dear God.
But I could say, you know, and the fact that Lin-Manuel Miranda created this piece, I don't think that there's any chance of that happening. I think that it's going to happen the way that he wants it to happen, or it's not going to happen.
Lin's really faithful to his colleagues and his friends. His standby has been his standby for 10 years. I remember in his Tony's acceptance speech for In the Heights, he rapped, "I don't know about God, but I believe in Chris Jackson, and look who's playing George Washington." He's so faithful and loyal to his company of actors and friends. I really doubt that Hamilton would lose any of its integrity if he was involved in it being made into a movie.
So let me just weigh in for just a minute here that I had a very difficult time with the first maybe 10 minutes of the show to get understand the rap. And which is surprising for me because I didn't expect that because outside of my musical theater tapes, I listened to a lot of rap. And so I didn't expect that. And I actually I asked Shane Marshall Brown over at Sam Rudy's office for a script, and he sent it to me so I can get back into it. And reading the script, I have to go see the show another 10 times. I loved it so much. I thought it was amazing. And the other thing I wanted to point out to our listeners is that, Lin-Manuel Miranda has been working on this for a long time. I'm including in the show notes a 2009 video of Lin at the White House performing a little piece from Hamilton. 2009, we're talking 6 years ago, and he had been working on it for years already at that point. I'm blown out by the production. I loved it. In my discussion with other folks in the theater community and other producers, everybody's afraid to come in with their productions because they feel like this is going to be a sweep. And I wonder if, especially in maybe the supporting categories, we're going to have multiple nominations and these people might cross-eliminate themselves. And it'll be interesting to see how the politics of the Tony nomination process goes and if the producers of Hamilton will hold back some people in different categories so not to have them split the vote per se in that. But I loved it. I think, we've been saying for months everybody should get tickets, and it's really hard to get tickets. I think the advance now is in the 50 million range. 50 million means that you're not touched. It's in essence sold out, not a ticket to be had for the next year.
Well, and it's what a time for the public theater, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, they have Fun Home, which
Which just means, why did they cut the budget on Cymbeline?
Yes.
I didn't know we did that. Oh, but you know what? When I went, I guess maybe it was just that night, but for Cymbeline, there were Spanish surtitles on screens on either side of the stage. I suppose that's only for certain performances.
If you press SAP on your remote, they go away.
No, I don't think so. Not in this case.
Okay. So Peter will be seeing Hamilton next week, so we'll extend our conversation about Hamilton into the next week. But last week or the week before, Peter, you went up to Newtown, Connecticut to see Liberty Smith, didn't you?
Yes, this is a musical that takes place in the same time period as Hamilton. George Washington's a character, Thomas Jefferson's a character. And this is, of course, is the town where the terrible tragedy happened on December 14th, 2012, where Adam Lanza took the gun that his mother gave him as a present and killed her, and then went to the Sandy Hook Elementary School and executed 20 kids and 6 staff members. So Van Dien, a Broadway producer, and Michael Unger, a director, and Jeffrey Saber, a musical director, thought that something had to be done, and they decided to do musicals there each summer. They did Seussical a couple of years ago, and I'm telling you, Lynn Ahrens and I looked at each other during the show and shed what had to be a pint of tears each, because it really was something to watch these 20 kids up there, wondering what they saw, what they remembered, what their nightmares are. So now this was done with high school kids, middle school kids, and grammar school kids, and it's a great show for kids. I know that when it opened in Washington a few years ago, The reviews weren't so hot, but they've done a lot of work on it. They changed the concept of the show, and I think it's a very smart idea. It used to be about a guy named Liberty Smith who said, you know, during the Revolutionary War, I was really responsible for a lot of things. Well, now it's a young girl in history class named Libby Smith who is telling the class that, after all, you don't know this, but my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was really responsible for a lot of things in the Revolutionary War. So she's essentially telling tall tales, though we get the impression she truly believes it. But, for example, it was he who was holding the kite, Liberty Smith was holding the kite when Ben Franklin had to take a break, and he's the one who had that shock that talked about electricity. He's the one who had the idea for the Boston Tea Party, which is why his followers called themselves the Sons of Liberty. Paul Revere had a little bit too much to drink before he was to make his midnight ride, so Liberty had to do the driving and alert the countryside that the British are coming. But Paul said, look, don't tell my wife I was drunk, will you? And so all this is what it's all. It's very fanciful, very funny. What it really is Forrest Gump set to music. You know, that's what it really is, because, of course, none of these things truly happen. But there's a marvelous, marvelous subplot, in essence, that deals with how difficult it was to be a woman during that period of time. Because here's Martha Dandridge, whom Liberty loves. She's crazy for her, but she says, look, you know, I'm an unempowered woman. She doesn't use that word. But anyway, I'm an unempowered woman, and, you know, my father wants me to marry money, and you just don't have it. That's all there is to it. I got to marry money because I've got to be secure. And she does. And eventually she'll wind up marrying George Washington, too. So Liberty is ostensibly left out in the cold. However, the most interesting character is a woman named Emily Andrews. Now, Emily Andrews works for Betsy Ross. But she hears that Ben Franklin has an apprenticeship open, and she wants it. But Ben doesn't even remotely see a woman as a possibility in this role. So as a result, he hires Liberty Smith. Now, she likes him. She might even be able to love Liberty Smith. However, he's so crazy about Martha that not only is that a roadblock, but the point is she has contempt for him because Martha is not portrayed, perhaps unfairly, as the brightest bulb on the tree. She can only read little words that are far apart, as it mentions in the script. So she just thinks that he's just in love with her because of her beauty, and why would that mean anything? In fact, the reason he joins the Revolutionary War is because he wants to impress her. And she, Emily says, if she loved you, you wouldn't have to do anything at all to impress her. So it's very nice. They will get together under a very fine circumstances, and all ends as happily as can. And of course, we do have a new nation that comes into play here as well, which is really quite good. But I will admit that there are tons of anachronisms, which I usually hate. However, I think this show gets away with it because the kid is narrating the tale. And a kid who's like in the eighth grade or so doing this type of thing might use anachronisms purposely to amuse the kids in the class, or just use them because it seems natural to her. For example, there were two Dixie cups on a string, you know, the people are communicating by. Can you hear me now? George Washington actually at one point makes a speech, and he says, I am George Washington, and I have approved this message. Things like that, okay? Though there's one I think is really, really smart. When Martha's mother suggests that she try finding a worthy suitor in Philadelphia, Liberty says, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. Now, that's good because Philadelphia, not New York, was the big city at that time, you know, so I think that's a very good joke. So there's a lot of that. But I'll tell you, I was laughing throughout because kids doing it makes a tremendous difference. I'm not sure that this would really fly as well with done by adults as a real $162 a ticket Broadway musical. But it should be licensed and it should be done by kids because a lot of fun is to be had. And I have to admit that when George Washington cried victory, it almost seemed like a victory over Adam Lanza. It's impossible not to think about those 20 kids who could have been on that stage. Mm. In fact, I wondered, if the script to Liberty Smith was written some, it was written some time ago, if there's an allusion to the right to bear arms, or because you know, that of course came up during the Revolution. I will say there was a mention of the Boston Massacre, and somehow there was a silence from the crowd that I think people really were tying that into what had happened here. One thing I have to say, at intermission, I went up to Michael Unger and I to tell him how thrilled I was. And I said, and that kid playing Ben Franklin, you must have been so thrilled the moment he walked through the door. And he said, she. Yeah, it was really great. I mean, the second act, I don't. Yeah, that is a girl. But Melissa Shohei was very good at playing Ben Franklin and really threw herself into it and had a right voice for it and all that. So I hope that this gets licensed, because a lot of people who want to do shows about the Revolutionary War may not have enough boys to do 1776. In mm-hmm. fact, I was in Stoneham, Massachusetts, and saw a production of Damn Yankees with children, and all the ball players were girls for the Washington Senators. This creates a bit of a problem, because I'm thinking about the Yankees, you know, oh, so you beat a bunch of girls, huh? You can be really proud of yourself. So so anyway, this is a good one. It gets you thinking about history. It gets you thinking about the Revolutionary War. It's really nice at the end when Ben Franklin celebrates the white, red, and blue, only to have Liberty correct him and say, you know, red, white, and blue sounds better. You know, so it's that type of show. And I had a wonderful time at it. And I hope I see it again and again in school settings.
Wow, that's wonderful. Listeners may remember that we had Van Deen on the broadcast here a few years back, and I'll put a link to that. Van Deen is a Broadway producer. He is a founder of Broadway Records, which does cast recordings, and has taken an active interest in supporting the Newtown area after the tragedy through the 1214 Foundation. So let's move on. Carrie, you wrote an article for Playbill that we want to talk about, called Career or Children, Why Theater Parents Feel Forced to Choose. And we want to say that theater parents really are theater professionals who are also parents. Is that a good description of what is meant by the headline there?
Yes, or people in the theater industry who are thinking about being parents, but don't know if they can because of the circumstances. Mm-hmm.
So give us a rundown of this article.
Well, that's 4 months of work.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I began doing the research and collecting the interviews back in April. It was just a result of a lot of conversations I've had with different people in the industry, men and women, saying that basically, unless you're very, very rich, it's often an either or situation, and that you can have a full career that you devote all your time and energy to, or you can be a parent. More women than men did speak to me for the article, but I fully recognize and acknowledge this is an issue that affects both women and men. But with a lot of female playwrights that I spoke with, they said that if they want to have children, they often can't go to different writing retreats and workshop centers in the summer, because they can't bring their children with them, and that can have a very negative impact on their work and its visibility. And when you think about how many shows started at wonderful places like the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center, it really is affecting them. So I'm hoping that the article will inspire some more conversations about this subject and what could be looked at again and possibly adjusted to either be more family friendly or let the parents bring their kids with them. I spoke with several people from the Lily Awards, and Julia Jordan told me about a writing retreat where parents could bring their children, and said that it was very well received, and hopefully that will become more of the norm, because male or female, actor, writer, director, anyone in this industry, I really hope that they won't have to make it an either or choice anymore, to reference the baker's wife from Into the Woods. But it was a big eye opener for me. I don't have children myself, and I learned quite a bit from talking with all these people, and I have nannied and babysat and been around children a lot. But hearing the day-to-day impact as well as the long-term impact was very educational for me, and I hope that the article will serve as some education for other people as well.
So the writer's retreat that you referred to is at this space on Writer Farm.
Yes.
Because Georgia Stitt, who's a writer, had, and we've had her on the broadcast here before, posted on Facebook a bunch of things from that a few weeks ago where she was at, and she brought her kids. Mm-hmm. And she talked about how incredible it was to be able to focus on your writing and also have childcare there, but also be able to spend time with your children later on in the day when you're not in your writing seminars or in your writing creation groups. So I think that it is really is a lot of. It seems like there's so much social change happening in the last couple of years, and it's all. It seems to be all for the positive. So we're very.
I hope so. One person said to me, we put it off for as long as we can.
Yeah.
And for a lot of women, that is the late 30s or early 40s. And for a lot of female writers, that's when they're hitting their stride. And some people have said, well, why don't they just take 5 years off? 5 years isn't that long of a time. And then their kids will be in kindergarten. But 5 years is a really long time to not be able to practice your craft, whether it's writing, acting, singing. That's a really long time. And to try to get back into the field after that, I've been told, is a big challenge.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can think of, at least two people that leap immediately to mind as two examples of people who sort of put their careers on hold for a while in order to raise families, Patti LuPone and Judy Kuhn.
Sure.
So, yeah. And those are only two that leap to mind immediately. So I think that, perhaps if there had been more more resources, as Carrie's discussing, that we might have seen maybe more of those people during those periods. So those are only two examples.
Yeah, we missed them desperately when they did that.
Yes.
Well, also going back to what we said about how long Lin-Manuel spent writing Hamilton, and he spent close to a decade working on In the Heights, I think. If he had taken 5 years off, where would Hamilton be?
Exactly.
Exactly.
But I suppose it's a little easier for writers than actors because you can't. I mean, to some extent, you can write at home.
What they were telling me about these writing retreats is that's where you get the workshops. That's where you can see your work being done, and that's where producers will take an interest in it. And if they can't go to these workshops, sure, you can do the writing. But what Marsha Norman said to me was, you can't walk out into the street and march around with a stack of papers shouting, I have written a fabulous play. You need people with money to see it, and those people are at those workshops. And if they can't go to the workshops, what's the point of writing a fabulous play if no one will see it, produce it, work on it, or invest in the time that you put into it?
I have to also point out that on paper, it seems totally feasible to work from home, and it just does not work.
Yes,
I want to. I tell you, from the business that I built, I can pretty much work from anywhere, and I worked from home. See, I got a little bell for that one. And I worked from home for a few years. And I got nothing done because my children climbing on me. And your children are totally quiet until the most important client calls you up on the phone or you're closing a deal or you're having a conference call. And then the children and your spouse and the cats and everybody will come and wake. I took an office that is 10 minutes away from my house just so I can go to a space to work at, and you have to get away from your family in order to be productive in many cases. So,
Sarah Ruhl wrote a wonderful book called 100 Essays I Don't Have Time to Write, and a lot of them are about being a working parent, and the very first essay in the book has her writing about being a parent who's a writer, and then a line stops, and then the numeral 7 is the next line because her son had come up to the computer and pressed that button. And I spoke with Sarah at great length to this article, and several other people told me that they had reached out to Sarah for help when they were thinking about being parents or had become pregnant and then thought, how do I do this? And I'd really recommend reading those essays. Sarah's a fantastic writer, and it was a big eye-opener for me reading about being a writer and a parent of three. And she told me when she was pregnant with twins, she didn't know she'd be able to write again. And I think that would be a great loss to the theater if Sarah Ruhl wasn't writing plays.
Absolutely. Well, Carrie, this is an incredible series of of articles that you continue to do on Playbill, and we'll
Thank
link
you.
To this on Playbill so that our listeners can check it out for themselves, and we look forward to the next one. And, you know, 4 months of work. I hope that the next one's not 4 months away.
But this was worth every minute, though. I'm really happy to have written it.
All right, so let's wrap up for today. Before we go into our credits and talk about trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and get us streamed to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, for Carrie, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today, including links to Raul's interview on Broadway Radio, Van Deen's interview, that Lin-Manuel Miranda YouTube video where from 2009, and the link to Carrie's article. So, Peter, do we have an answer for last week's, a couple of weeks ago, trivia?
Yeah, I had asked what 80s musical... and a rather famous one for that matter, with a four-word title, referenced a 40s musical. And that was Woman of the Year, which has a song called So What Else Is New, in which Ira Gershwin's Lady in the Dark is mentioned. So, as I said, the first words were synonymous, woman, lady. I also mentioned that one of the words was exactly the same, the. So that's the answer. And by the way, if you've never heard Woman of the Year, you can now, because Sony Masterworks Broadway is re-releasing the cast album, which was on the Arista label way back when. So it's a pretty good score. Kendra and Eva were the first to admit that they did it as a vehicle for Lauren McCall, and it turned out rather well. I mean, they won Best Score, Peter Stone won Best Book, McCall won Best Actress, and Marilyn Cooper, a real trooper from way back when, who was really down and out before Woman of the Year. She lived in the building next to me. I used to see her all the time. And Marilyn was an understudy in Ballroom a year and a half before Woman of the Year happened. So she was relegated to that status. And here she was suddenly having one scene, one song, and one Tony Award as a result. So so you can hear her really terrific song, The Grass Is Always Greener, though whenever she was interviewed about that, she used to say, well, it is a duet, you know, because Lauren Bacall was certainly part of the number as well, and a very important part, too. But it tends to be a case where people remember Marilyn Cooper in that song much more than they remember Lauren Bacall. Anyway, this week's trivia question. All right. 40 years have passed since Chorus Line opened, and this is a Chorus Line question. When Chorus Line opened, started previews, I should say, at the Public Theater, the song in the playbill was called Tits and Ass. Okay, fine. Suddenly people were noticing that nobody was laughing at the song, which was really rather funny. So they changed the title. Now, actually, they changed the title twice. The title we know today, Dance 10, Looks 3, was not the first title they chose. What was the first title they chose between Tits and Ass and Dance 10 Looks 3?
I don't know. I thought I knew the story, but I guess not.
Well, if you do have an answer for that, send an email to trivia@BroadwayRadio.com, and we'll take a look at the answers that come through and let you know, hopefully next week if I remember. So, Peter, just before we run away, we had Brian Hargrove on last week to talk about It Should Have Been You and the cast recording that's been released or in digital form so far. And he talked about how great MTI was to have picked up It Should Have Been You, and it's already gotten a lot of response. So the licensing folks at MTI are working really hard there to get that out there, which is awesome. And
which reminds me, I've got to write an article about that. I'm glad you brought it up.
Excellent. I look forward to that. And I saw on that little website, playbill.com, that there was an interview with Andrew Lippa. And they are one of the things that we talked about with Wild Party at City Center off-center. I always get that wrong.
Encore's off-center.
Encore's off-center. That Wild Party is licensing the original version, which is one of the questions I had, what are they licensing? But that Andrew is actively trying to get this new version that he wrote into regional productions and is talking with a bunch of people about that. So if you didn't get a chance to see the Encores production this summer, it was I think three or four performances, very short. Perhaps we'll be able to see it around the country, and I'll look for our listeners to email us and let us know what they think about that, or even call us and let us know what they think about that. Our phone number is actually on our page at Broadway Radio. The phone number is 888-285-4666, which you can call and leave us a voicemail. So on behalf of Michael Portantier, Peter Felicia, and Carrie Purcell, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.